podcast from Literary Hub, where we believe that nearly every issue that shows up in your Twitter feed or on the evening news has already been tackled somewhere in literature. I'm Whitney Terrell, author of the novel The Good Lieutenant.
I'm Vivi Ganeshanathan, also known as Sugi, and the author of Love Marriage. Or actually, I'm not yet, because it's 1997, and I'm in Bethesda, Maryland, where it is more or less 35 degrees. And I'm a senior in high school.
Seriously?
Yep. Where were you in the winter of 1997?
I was here in Kansas City, freezing like I am now. I was living on Virginia, a little house that I just wrote an essay about, actually. I'd moved here from New York. I hadn't published anything. I was in better shape. Where were you, Oscar?
I was in San Francisco. I was working at the San Francisco Chronicle as a copy editor in the date book section.
Nice.
So I was a young man enjoying the city before any of the .com anything happened.
That's Oscar Villalón, who will go on to be the books editor for the San Francisco Chronicle from 2001 to 2008, board member of the National Book Critics Circle, and managing editor of the great literary magazine Zizibah. We're a podcast that talks about the news through literature, and there has been no shortage of heavy-duty news in 2017, as our first six episodes attest. So in the holiday spirit,
and an effort to escape some of today's news,
we decided to imagine what it would be like to do our show 20 years ago. You can ignore the fact that there were no podcasts then, and we've got Oscar on with us to tell us what the literary landscape looked like that year.
Yeah, it was fairly interesting. There were a lot of big books that came out, but none of the big books, for the most part, did well in terms of awards and prizes and stuff. Let me give you an example. So 1997, so that April, when the Pulitzers are announced, a little book, and I do mean little, I think it was maybe about 150 pages long or so, Stephen Milhauser's Martin Bressler. Do you guys remember that?
Oh, yeah.
I do.
That's right. He comes out. He wins the Pulitzer. And interestingly enough, the two finalists also were smaller books. One was Joanna Scott's The Mannequin. And someone who I think is getting, could you call a second one, maybe third one, fourth one, Ursula K. Le Guin. She was a finalist for her short story collection, Unlocking the Air. Now, there were some really big books. And by that, I mean books by people now we pretty much seem to agree are going to wake their way into the canon if they're not already there. The first one probably you guys remember would be Don DeLillo's Underworld, the tome of a book. That came out in 97. And then later on in that year, you had Philip Roth came out with American Pastoral, which I think was book two of a sort of trilogy he was working on, talking about, I guess, post-war America, if I recall correctly.
Sabbath Theater was the first part of that?
Right. I believe so. Sabbath Theater, then American Pastoral. And I think the third one, I want to say, or maybe Pastoral was the third, but somewhere in there was I Married a Communist. I don't know if you guys remember that. But anyway, those two came out. There was this other little book you guys might have heard of, Angela's Ashes.
Yeah.
That won the Pulitzer, too, for, I think, biography, autobiography. Though, you know, if we go back into the Wayback Machine, and if we want to shuttle forward into the future a little bit, I think there are some questions about maybe how the veracity of Angela's Ashes that came out some years later. I think it's probably a moot point now. But anyway, we had that. And then, we had, there was tons of other stuff. I mean, the National Book Critics Circle that year, they were giving the award out to Penelope Fitzgerald. You remember that?
I love her as a writer.
Yeah.
She has to be so inspirational.
Yeah.
Not only is she an exquisite writer, but I think she started her career so late, yeah. I think. Am I correct in saying that? She's an example, I think, of how, particularly for women writers, how tough it is sometimes to make a career out of this, especially if you have to, don't have the means to start writing right away, either because you have to work to support yourself or support your family or raise a family, these sort of things. So Fitzgerald, I think something of a what you could call her a late bloomer. I wouldn't call her a late bloomer. She just, you write when you're ready to write.
The thing I remember, about Underworld was that opening passage about Bobby Thompson's home run. I feel like there were at least three or four, maybe four or five reviews that sort of broke down the technical virtuosity of that passage, went deeply in depth into the way that it was described. But a lot of them went on to say that the rest of the book maybe wasn't quite as good as that very long opening passage. And then, of course, there was the cover with the World Trade Centers on the front of it.
And 1997 was also the year that Ramzi Youssef was convicted of bombing the World Trade Center. I remember that The God of Small Things won the Booker, and I was really obsessed with that book. I just read it. I read it in order. I read it out of order. I read it backwards. I just loved it. And of course, that was also before people had started telling basically all South Asian women writers that we were all like Arundhati Roy or Jhumpa Lahiri.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. You know, the funny thing, I remember reading The God of Small Things and absolutely being blown away by it. I thought the writing was so beautiful. It also was intriguing, too, was I don't think at that time, people in the United States who were not at all familiar with India or Indian culture knew that there was such a thing as a Christian community in India. And I think, as you recall, that was part of that story. That's right. Underworld was huge. I do remember reading the excerpt from the beginning, the Bobby Thompson, The Shot Heard Around the World. I think that appeared in like Harper's year before when they had that folio section. And I found the rest of I had no problem with the rest of the book. I didn't think it lost any of its power. You know, I think it just got grimmer and grimmer, which maybe that's what people meant.
Yeah. No, I thought it was a great book. I mean, I'm a huge DeLillo fan, and I was very excited for that book to come out. But I sort of wonder how many of these books feel prescient to you or to Sugi. And I remember, you know, the cover that I mentioned of Underworld would kind of become a meme in a time before memes, you know, after the 9/11 attacks in 2001. But are there other books here that sort of give you guys a sense of what's to come? Or do these books tell us how different people's concerns were 20 years ago?
Well, that's a good question. I'll try to answer that first. I would say, in terms of fiction, if there was anything that was prescient, well, let's go back to Underworld and American Pastoral.
Yeah,
it's been a long time since I read both, but broadly speaking, as I recall, there is a sense in both books of a rot in American society.
Yeah.
I think in American Pastoral, it's more kind of aligned with the sort of a retelling of the Book of Job. So it makes it sound like it comes, you know, perhaps as though some sort of divine affliction. But there is definitely a sense that there's something rotten underneath this middle class existence or upper middle class existence in the case of American Pastoral. We're losing touch with reality. And in the course of losing touch with reality, something's festering. And the same thing with Underworld. I mean, you read Underworld, you know, this is not going to end well for all of us. You know, as we start building and building to this idea of cataclysm, right? And was it the nuclear waste out in the desert? Am I calling that correctly? And then heroin shows up again. I mean, it's not exactly prescient, but, you know, both of them seem to be saying that we're not quite right. I would say, in terms of nonfiction, there were probably a couple of books that seemed prescient. One of them was by this art historian, David King, The Commissar Vanishes, The Falsification of Photographs in Art in Stalin's Russia. Do you guys remember that?
No, but that's why we have you on the show.
That's fascinating.
Henry Holt published it. It was a big book. I mean, literally big in terms of oversize. Where David King, this art historian, showed how people were literally erased from Stalin's Russia, out of the records.
Oh, wait, I think I might remember something about this. Yeah.
Right? And they were airbrushed out in some cases, or their faces were just scribbled out. But nonetheless, that the part of his way of maintaining power was simply to say, this never happened. You know, it's almost like, I don't know, having a president who insists that his inauguration was the biggest one ever, even though there's tons of photographic evidence to the contrary. And then at some point someone say, imagine if you repeopled them and then put out that photo and said, no, see, actually it was the biggest thing. And then I would say the other book was, do you guys remember Iris Chang's The Rape of Nanking? That was giant. I mean, it was a mega best. I mean, for the subject matter, it was a huge bestseller. I think it sold 125,000 copies in the first 4 months. But it was an example, I would say, in terms of being prescient, of a writer. In this case, Iris Chang, who sadly killed herself not too long after the success of her book.
Oh, no.
She wanted to write about what she thought was a criminally perhaps literally criminally overlooked piece of history, which is what happened during the Japanese occupation of Nanjing, of Manchuria. And it was, I mean, it was a wake-up call to most people. Most Americans certainly had never heard of this. Had never known the scale of atrocity that had gone on there. And it was hugely controversial because you had then people in Japan, mostly from ultra-right-wing parties, saying that, no, we addressed this. This has been talked about before. But actually, if my understanding of this is correct, wasn't talked about at all, wasn't even being taught in history, in Japanese history in the schools there. But I would say that was prescient too, only in the sense of that I think we're living in a time now where we want to explore what happened in the past and talk about wrongs in a way, and particularly I think with Iris Chang's book, that is also full of passion, of saying that, you know, yes, this is history, and you want to look at it dispassionately, but also we need to do something about this. You should be outraged that this happened.
Mm. I mean, now I feel like there's so many writers. I would love to see even more, but so many writers who are, say coming from non-white backgrounds or from non-American backgrounds, who are writing about marginalized histories in some way. And this is very much sort of the discussion of the moment, at least in my possibly limited circle. But when you look back at the 1997 prize lists, they're very white, they're very male. And I was struggling to find any writers of color among the winners or nominees of the major prizes. Jamaica Kincaid was a finalist for the NBA nonfiction. And there also weren't a ton of books, big books with queer themes. Brokeback Mountain came out in the New Yorker in 1997, and that obviously was a landmark. But can you think of anything else?
So there were other books that came out that year, I think, by writers who were not white men that I think would have been, in my opinion, worthy of award consideration. Maybe they were. They just didn't make the finalists, the list of finalists. Among them, Margaret Atwood's Alias Grace, Christina Garcia's The Aguero Sisters, Mary Gaitskill's Story Collection, because they wanted to. the wonderful Molly Giles, her story collection, A Creek Walk. Edna O'Brien, Down by the River.
Wow.
I don't know if and then later on, you know, if you look deeper into the list, you see that, oh, yes, Edmund White came out with the Farewell Symphony that year.
Yeah, I noted that one. And also Toni Morrison published Paradise, which was her first novel since she'd won the Nobel Prize, and Sapphire published Push the year before in 96, which would go on to become a huge film in 2009. Those are people, like Edmund and Margaret Atwood, those are people whose reputations have definitely climbed, right, since that time. You see people on some of these award lists that actually we haven't heard much from them since this time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, I'll tell you what. You look back 20 years, any time in literature or in terms of what's being published, it's brutal. You know, it is absolutely brutal. You know, I mean,
the judges do not always get it right.
No, they don't, you know. And it's fascinating to see what sort of books are sort of like, oh, yeah, and in other news, the ones that made that list, who now, I mean, like Margaret Atwood, Alias Grace, for goodness sake.
She's one of the most famous writers in the world right now.
Absolutely, you know. Colm Tóibín, by the way, came out with a novel that year, too.
Oh, really?
The Story of the Night, yeah. Yes. And then, you know, so that would be examples. Probably the most interesting example, though, of a writer of color, and a writer who definitely I think is now probably more read than he was at the time when his first book came out, which happens a lot. But Hilton Alls, he came out with his first book then, The Women.
Oh wow!
Yeah, you know, so there's plenty of good stuff. You know, it's just, I think it's
so, listeners,
you know what it is?
Read around the prizes. Don't always follow what the prizes say. That's what that bit of information tells you 20 years in the future.
Well, I think this goes to something what Sugi was talking about, which is who gets the spotlight.
Yeah.
Right? Those are all the stuff, all those books I rattled off. Those are all eminently worthy of further exploration and more visibility in terms of coverage. I think, you know, nowadays, let's put it this way, if all those books had come out this year, I think they definitely would have been talked about more.
Yeah, yeah. I remember that everyone was also reading that Charles Frazier Civil War book, Cold Mountain.
Yes,
which is, right. You know, told from the point of view of a Confederate deserter, universally praised, huge bestseller, if I'm remembering right. You know, but I kind of wonder if that book would be greeted with the same reception today, because I'm looking at the way that people are talking about the proposed HBO show Confederates. You know, kind of that show ran into this sort of withering barrage of criticism, you know, for reasons that it seems to me at least would now apply to Cold Mountain.
One can only speculate, but I think the reception may not be nearly as warm as it was in 97. You know, you just think, you know, given what the story's about and given the point of view it's told from,
yeah,
you can, it's not hard to imagine people saying, so is this some sort of apologia for the Confederacy?
Yes.
That not all Confederate soldiers were bad?
That is not a popular opinion post-Charlottesville.
No, it is not. And, you know, which is not to detract from the book itself and what the text has to say, et cetera. But it is to speak a lot about the times and the zeitgeist, yeah, and how when a book enters into a certain zeitgeist, its success, at least in terms of its commercial success, could really be affected by that.
I mean, the advent of the internet obviously plays a role here. I think, and I've thought a little bit about this, Oscar, maybe you could speak to how many reviewers of color were active in 1997, but I'd sort of suspect not that many. It's also been my impression that the ranks of staff reviewers haven't diversified that much since then. But now we have this sort of thing where, I mean, a lot of the discussion about Confederates with that you're referring to, like, no, that show got dragged on Twitter. And then you've got mainstream media sort of covering, well, there was a discussion on Twitter. And that is a way of sort of amplifying a different set of voices.
So 1997, I was still a copy editor and date book. But by 1998, I would be hired to be the deputy book editor for the San Francisco Chronicle. So I got a much better sense in terms of reviewers and who was doing what. I don't recall there being a ton of diversity, and I say this with a little bit of caution, because this is obviously before social media, and sometimes you never met people. You wouldn't meet them in person. At best, you might talk to them on the phone. So there's really no way necessarily outside of surnames to know maybe who someone was. And certainly there was no way to know about, you know, people's sexual orientation, et cetera, these sort of things, right?
Yeah.
So with that caveat, it didn't seem to be a lot. I will say, of course, Michiko Kakutani, she was doing her thing. That's at the New York Times. Maria Rana was either the editor or one of the editors at the Washington Post Book World.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, we had at the San Francisco Chronicle, we had Pat Holt, who was running the book review and was also doing, this is going to blow your mind, I kid you not, cranking out a review a day.
Wow.
Yeah, it boggles the mind still to this day, but God bless Pat. She could do that.
Was Jabari Asim reviewing at this time? I know that he was reviewing sort of in the early 2000s.
I think so. It's quite possible.
Yeah.
You know, but there you go. Then you kind of start going, well, you know, I mean, there were a lot of women. Elizabeth Taylor was still, I think she was doing her thing at the Chicago Tribune.
Yeah.
But in terms of reviewers of color or book editors of color, not a ton. I think he might have been the Washington Post at the time, actually. Now I'm thinking on it. So the Post might have had Maria Rana, which is not bad. The New York Times, I mean, outside Michiko outside what she's doing in the Daily, right? Which, because she was doing that in the New York Times Daily, I don't know what the staffing looked like at the Sunday Book Review. I couldn't tell you. But there wasn't a lot.
What would have been the Twitter of 1997? I mean, how did people talk to each other? I still kind of wrote actual physical letters then, although I think I did have an AOL account that I would check like every 3 or 4 days on dial-up with that little sound, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it was email, or you met them at, you know, Book Expo. The channels for networking were much, much more narrow than they are today. You know, I think one of the great things about social media, it makes it so much easier to reach out to editors, so much easier to be, you know, discovered, which is to say, reaching out to someone and saying, hey, would you mind, you know, can I pitch you on a review or whatever it might be? that wasn't impossible in 97, but it was certainly more work.
Did the experience of reading change for you, do you think, between 1997 and today? For me, I feel like it was a quieter experience. In other words, I was much more likely to come to a book with no idea what people were saying about it ahead of time, and then encounter it. And then if I liked it, I would maybe go and seek out what people were saying about it. Whereas today, it's very hard for me to not already have heard things about a book before I come to read it.
Oh, I just really miss that. Like, I wish that I so preferred that method, because I think now often I think that particularly women and people of color, like, they get sort of the presumption of autobiographical writing sort of thrown at their work. And I really just don't have, I just would rather go to the work. And I think that there's so many ways in which this sort of like what people are saying about it really detracts from, they're sort of a gossipy or like actually not as critical, not as rigorous or not as thoughtful, not as text-based. Oftentimes my problems with the ways things are talked about have to do with the criticism and not with the books themselves. It's not just books. I mean, movies, TV shows, but also books.
I literally have this memory of going into, I was living in New York when I read Sabbath Theater, the sort of this beginning of this Roth resurgence. And he's an author who's highly criticized now for many reasons. But I remember seeing it on the stacks in the local public library on like somewhere. I mean, I lived on 13th and 3rd and walking home in the snow and thinking, oh, my God, I didn't know he wrote a new book. Well, I'll check it out, you know, and reading it basically in my apartment, you know, and it was cold and there wasn't anyone around. And I just read this book and thought about it, you know. I don't think that would be possible today.
I agree, but I think it may just be just in general, just how much more noise there is. It's hard to be in the present now, much harder than it was in 97. You know, think about how few distractions there were for your reading. I mean, the only distractions would be if you decided to go turn on the TV. You know, that's about it. You know, you could be alone. You know, if someone wanted to reach you, they could call your cell phone. But that's about it. Yeah. You know, you weren't going to be on there the whole time. You weren't easily available. I agree with both of you. And I will say this thing too, very quickly though, about Roth. You're right. There's a lot of people who dislike him for good reasons. But as I like to tell writers, particularly emerging writers, people who are just learning their craft, you know, steal from the best. You don't have to like them. You don't have to like them. But you need to appreciate what he does. I'll give you an example. I don't like Bill Belichick. I'm a big football fan. I don't like him.
Oh, my God.
But I certainly like how he runs those offenses and defenses. Steal from the best. You don't have to emulate the person. You don't have to, you know, espouse their philosophy. But look what he or she does with a sentence. You know, you're a writer. It's your craft. Just take what you need from that. You know, don't throw out the baby with the bathwater, so to speak, right? He could still be exactly what he is and what you say he is, and I don't disagree. But, you know, there's a genius in the way those paragraph and sentences are constructed. Learn from that. You know, employ that in your own work.
The Ghostwriter is a book that I learned a tremendous amount from. It's a really beautiful, incredibly intelligent book.
I was just going to ask Oscar, you listed this amazing roster of books from this year. And also, the ways that reading has changed. And I'm wondering, what was your favorite reading experience from that year? This amazing list. Like, some of which made those lists, and some of which didn't.
I'll tell you. So, oddly enough, there's two books that stick out, and they're none of the books that we mentioned. Although I think I read most of them. John Banville's The Untouchable came out in '97. Did you guys read that? It's absolutely exquisite. It's supposed to be basically the story of Anthony Blunt, who was part of Kim Philby's spy ring. Gorgeous novel. I highly, highly recommend it.
Banville's one of those guys that I didn't become aware of until he won a prize, sadly.
Yeah, and there's supposed to be a character in the novel who's Graham Greene, who does not come off well at all. but really, I highly recommend it. And the other one, which was a throwback, was The Complete Stories of Bernard Malamud. came out in 97.
Oh, speaking of the ghostwriter.
Right. This giant tome. And it was such a revelation to me. I don't know why I picked it up. To this day, I'm not sure why I bought it. Speaking to your point, what you're saying, Whit, that, you know, I didn't read any reviews about it. I just saw it was this big doorstopper of a volume. And there was so much pleasure to be had from that book. And one of the things I will say is this, there's a whole series of stories based on a character who may or may not be him, who lives in Rome. Are you familiar with these stories? They are wild. They're absolutely wild. And one ends, and I kid you not, remember, this is Bernard Malamud we're talking about. One of them ends with basically the protagonist more or less having, I guess you could say, rough sex with this Italian man.
Huh.
Yes, exactly. Bernard Malamud.
I read this.
Yes, it's quite descriptive. And it's one of those things that just comes out of nowhere. But then, you know, that's when you start realizing things, which one should realize is that, you know, the breadth of many of these artists, the different things they could do and the things they explore. I wasn't even aware that he had this sort of series of stories about an expat living in Rome. Stories that I thought were decidedly not at all what I was expecting from Malamud.
And Whit, how about you?
I would go with the Farewell Symphony. I mean, I'm a huge Edmund White fan, and you know, I just thought that was a really great book that has lasted and grown in reputation since it was published in 1997. It didn't get a lot of attention that year, so I'm going to give it some attention now.
Gosh, I've got such great recommended reading. I need to go and read Iris Chang immediately, and also these three books. I think that my sort of unoriginal but best beloved from that year is still Arundhati Roy. I was, like I said, a high school senior and very much removed from, I think, looking at prize lists when I was that age. But I was reading Washington Post Book World faithfully and kind of, and as I recall, my brother had this copy of The God of Small Things, and I would kind of go into his room and borrow it and not return it for just very long periods of time. And that book for me has been really formative. Oscar, it's been so wonderful to have you with us today to hear about this incredible period 20 years ago, where we should be looking at these same books in a different way now and be thinking about what's lasted and what hasn't and what prize lists are giving us and what they're not. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, no, thank you for having me.
It's such a pleasure to have you on, Oscar. Thanks.
Oh, no, you're welcome, Whit.
And now we're thrilled to welcome our next guest, Curtis Sittenfeld, who in 1997 hadn't yet published her best-selling novels, Prep, American Wife, and most recently, Eligible. Curtis, I bet your forthcoming collection, You Think It, I'll Say It, wasn't even a glint in your eye back in 1997. Welcome to the show. We're so looking forward to reading your book.
Thank you.
All right, so look, we were just talking to Oscar, the book critic, longtime book critic for the San Francisco Chronicle, and now editor of Ziziva, about influential books in 1997. What were you doing in 1997? What were you reading?
So in 1997, I was graduating from college. In June, I graduated from college. And then
this
I was...
This is like the show designed to make me feel old. So
I think there comes some point where like life just like is designed to make a person feel old. And I think I'm there already. But anyway, so the summer I graduated, I was an intern / general assignment reporter at the Charlotte Observer in Charlotte, North Carolina. And then pretty soon after that, when that internship ended, I became a reporter at the business magazine Fast Company in Boston.
Oh my God, I remember that.
Yeah, it still exists. It's in New York. It was super fat at the time. Like, it would have these crazy 400-page issues because, you know, like Silicon Valley was exploding, which of course I had like only a dim understanding of. But so I actually remember when I lived in Boston, I remember riding the subway. And I think in some ways, you know, I had been an English major, but there were certain books that I hadn't read that it was almost like I was choosing what I read entirely for myself for the first time in my life, instead of like sort of choosing and sort of having a teacher tell me what to read. And I remember I actually read Lolita on the T. I read Mona Simpson's novels. I'm a huge Mona Simpson fan. Around that time, I read Jennifer Egan's first novel, The Invisible Circus, which I thought was beautiful, like a really smart, sexy, beautiful, poignant coming of age story written in a very intelligent way about a young woman. I read a lot of like best American short stories, the O. Henry, like every year. It was an event for me when they came out.
Here is a book that I did not read in 1997, but I read parts of it in the paper. And it wasn't on any of these prize lists that we've been talking about, but I was working for the New York Observer, like Curtis. I was a journalist at one time in my life. And it was a good paper back before Jared Kushner bought it. And the thing that was big deal then was Candace Bushnell's Sex in the City column. This was in 96, and you know, sort of about the wealthy and well-heeled in New York and the Hamptons. And those columns came out as a book in 1997. Do any of you remember that?
No.
I don't know. I think I read maybe one or two of those columns, but I never have lived in New York. You know, even though obviously that's the center of publishing, and I've never been very sexy. So I watched the show, sort of like I don't have an encyclopedic knowledge of the show, but I've watched my fair share of episodes. But so I think I was aware of the phenomenon, but a little bit distantly.
I mean, it's interesting because, you know, that was turned into the huge HBO show, but that column had such influence but because it was in a New York paper that didn't really have a wide circulation. I mean, it was really small, but it was all the people in media read that column, and all of them were going to these parties, you know?
I mean, I think that that's often a phenomenon of like the sort of media insider with outsized influence, who today might be like someone on Twitter who has 800 followers, but all those followers are like editors in New York or comedians or, you know, what TV producers, like sort of tastemakers.
It's so interesting to me listening to hear you guys talk about this because Whit heard me mock myself in the earlier segment of this program before, because I mean, in 1997, I was in high school, and I think that, you know, hearing you talk about sort of what books came out in what year, et cetera, like I was so out of it in terms of these kinds of, I definitely had not heard of Candace Bushnell in 1997. I was going to live in New York, but not for almost another decade. And I think that my reading wasn't so pinned to one year. I think I got to Candace Bushnell maybe around the time I was in graduate school.
Well, I had never heard of her, but I was working at this paper, and suddenly, you know, here's this column, and everyone's like, "Whoa, you don't know about this?" And I felt like, you know, such a rube.
You know, it's funny because I feel like one thing I did do in 1997, which seems like a pretty dated habit, and I also feel like this is very revealing. I mean, one, I subscribed to a ton of magazines, like, including, I think I subscribed to like GQ. There was a time when I subscribed to Esquire, like all these men's magazines randomly. Vanity Fair, The New Yorker, like probably some women's magazines, like Glamour maybe, or Elle or something. And I used to, but just like sort of for pleasure or my own interest, I would read the masthead of magazines to see kind of like which editors were where. And so, which, if you think about that, you know, I was 22 or 23, that's sort of a weird habit to have, to live
awesome.
In Boston and read the, like, if you had said to me, like, will you be in the long term a journalist or a novelist? I don't think I would have had a clear idea which, or I don't even know if I knew that I literally could be a full-time novelist.
So we're talking a little bit about sort of the New York-centricness of some of these conversations, but you're from the Midwest and you've written essays about why you like the Midwest, and the novel that 1997 Curtis will someday write, Eligible, resets Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice in Cincinnati, and your new collection has stories set in the Midwest.
Yeah, even Kansas City, which I like to always note, including a mention of the school where I teach, UMKC, although the character has dropped out, but we're just going to skip that part. We all know this because a bunch of those stories from the new collection are published in The New Yorker, but, you know, it just doesn't seem to me like a Midwesterner could have that, like those kind of stories would be published in 1997. It seemed like it was a really New York-centric time in fiction writing.
That's interesting. It would be interesting to go back and, like, look at the 1997... you know, like stories in the New Yorker to see whether it, like, is that a gut feeling or is it borne out by, I mean, I remember, okay, so this is actually, I believe this is 1999, not 1997, but there was, the New Yorker did that, like 20 writers under 40. And it was like, it was, you know, all these people who've gone on to great acclaim, like Jonathan Franzen, and I can't remember, Jeffrey Eugenides, Juno Diaz, Jhumpa Lahiri, and I feel like it would be interesting how many of those people were based in New York. I think, you know, probably most of them. Matt Clam, I remember, like, those to me were the writers that I really admired at that time. Like, this is a comment, I'm a totally disgusting person I am. I bet that in my basement I still have that issue of The New Yorker from 1990.
I totally read those. I remembered those too, yeah. But that all just seemed like such a faraway life. I mean, it might have had something to do with the fact that we were all unpublished then rather than the fact that we didn't live in New York.
I mean, yeah, it's everything. I mean, in some ways, New York to me still seems like a faraway life. Like, it's, you know, I go and visit my publisher or see my agent and have lunch with them. And I think it's sort of a movie version of New York, but it's not really what it's like to live
there. We have a ton of New York listeners, so they can all laugh at us for our gawking at their lives. But, I mean, you know, I remember, this was later than 1997 that I went home. I had kept a subscription to The Observer, which would be mailed to me at my house in Kansas City. And I remember they did a map of literary Brooklyn, you know, listing where every writer lived in Brooklyn. And, you know, and that made me think, while I was thinking back to that, of your story, The Prairie Wife, which your future self would publish in, you know, 2017. And that story features a character, Lucy, who lives on a quote-unquote farm in Missouri and has become hugely famous as a sort of Martha Stewart for evangelicals, if that's a fair description. I wondered if you could read a section of that.
I would be delighted to read a section. Let me rustle some papers and find the section.
We do allow actual paper rustling when readings are occurring. It's our one sound effect.
Sanctioned paper rustling. That's actually the name of my podcast. Kidding. Okay. Lucy has 3.1 million followers. She follows a mere 533 accounts, many of which belong to fellow celebrities. Almost all of Lucy's vast social media empire, which of course is an extension of her lifestyle brand empire, whatever the fuck a lifestyle brand is, drives Kirsten crazy. Its content is fake and pandering and boring and repetitive. How many times will Lucy post variations on the same recipe for buttermilk biscuits? And Kirsten devours all of it every day. Facebook and Instagram, Tumblr and Pinterest, the blog, the TV show. Every night, Kirsten swears that she won't devote another minute to Lucy, and every day she squanders hours. The reason things go wrong so early in the morning, she has realized, is this. She's pretty sure Twitter is the only place where real, actual Lucy is posting. Lucy, whom Kirsten once knew. 20 years ago, Lucy swore like a normal person, but the Lucy of now, Kirsten thinks, resembles Casey, who, when their sons were younger, respectfully asked Kirsten to stop cursing in front of them. Indeed, the Lucy of now, beloved by evangelicals, homeschooler of her three daughters, wife of a man she refers to as the stud in overalls, who is a deacon in their church, uses such substitutes as Jiminy Crickets and Fudge Nuggets.
That's amazing. So tell me if I'm wrong, but that seems to me like the kind of fictional character who could not have existed in 1997, much less any New Yorker story. And for a ton of reasons that seem interesting to talk about, not the least of which being, as we discussed with Oscar, the iPhone hadn't been invented yet and Twitter and Facebook didn't exist. I have in mind here, when I was a kid, I loved this young adult series by a writer named Ellen Emerson Wright. And she recently published a fourth book, and I understand. I think she's going back and updating the earlier books with the internet and email, which is astonishing to me. And I just wonder kind of how you think about this and whether your character could have existed back 20 years ago.
I think the short answer is no, my character couldn't have existed. Like, because if you were going to be sort of preoccupied with a celebrity, you know, the like material or the sort of like drug or hit or whatever to feed your obsession would come so much more slowly. Like it was almost at one point my family subscribed to People magazine. And sometimes we would think, like my sisters and I would almost predict who would be on the cover of People. And so I think that like, you know, there's all this sort of micro news and it's so constant. And we know all this, these weirdly like intimate, banal details about celebrities. And so, and I think that that's a lot of what this story is about. And it's also about like sort of fake authenticity. And it's, I mean, it's kind of hard not to be either a fake person or a fake authentic person in this time. I mean, but also, really, I mean, not, feel free to cut this part, but even like the podcast, I mean, aren't they, there's kind of a fake authenticity there, right? I mean, there's a fake.
We're going for that as much as possible.
Well, that's definitely staying.
You put the authentic and fake authentic. But anyway, so I do feel like that story, it feels to me like a very contemporary story, by the way, about Ellen Emerson White. One, she's on Twitter. I follow her. She follows me. And two, those, I don't know, during Hillary Clinton's campaign, I was sort of hoping someone would go back and revisit, maybe like write an essay about those novels, because I loved them and read and reread them as a teenager, or no, probably younger than a teenager, maybe, you know, 12-ish or something. But I thought to myself, it's part of the reason I love Hillary Clinton and others don't, that like at such a young age it was conceivable to me to have a female president because of these books, or, you know, it's like it's, the mom is obviously the first female president, or the main character's mother. Anyway, do you know of anyone who went back and revisited those in fall 2016, like in an essay?
I mean, I did.
Oh, you wrote an essay about
it? No, I didn't. I didn't write an essay, but maybe I should have.
Come on, Sugi. I mean, get on it.
I know, right? I mean, I think I was feeling at a certain point, like, I mean, after the election, certainly, so sad that, I mean, rereading these books now is like they, for our readers, our listeners who might not know, this is a series called The President's Daughter by Ellen Emerson White. And the first three books came out quite a while ago and were sort of, I think, categorized as YA. And the fourth book, which is a 700-page tome, came out in, like, I think 2007. And at that point, the narrative includes the internet and email, and the main character Meg does things like while waiting for her date, checking her email and refreshing her messages, which was not part of my experience of reading the first set of books.
Yeah.
But I think, yeah, my love of probably a lot of my love of politics was born in reading those books. I just think of them as a very clear example of kind of before and after, you know, what did time and the internet do to our narratives? And here's this really clear example.
Well, also, I think that there's been a decentralization of celebrity culture, so that it is possible for somebody from the middle of Missouri or to create a fictional character who is that big of a celebrity from there. Whereas before, you would have had to live in New York, I think, or LA in order to get on TV and disseminate, you know, your fame in that way. I think that's one of the things. And I also think that in the age of Trump, you know, there's a reason why people now in New York are looking toward the heartland to try to figure out what the heck happened during that election.
Yes and no. I mean, I do feel like there's this phenomenon of like, almost like, you know, the article that's as if it's written to someone who's like written by a journalist who's like a foreign exchange student spending a week in the Midwest. And I find those articles incredibly cringe inducing. Like it feels
like
they're
doing a good job of figuring it out.
Yeah, they're doing a job. Trying. I mean, again, it's I am someone, like, when people are like, I hate the media, I'm like, I love the media. So I don't want to make, like, sweeping criticisms, but some of that particular kind of article feels like the person could have written it, like, they knew what their thesis was before they left, like, DC or New York, and then they got people to kind of say what they wanted to say. Like, something that I think that it was one of my motivations for writing the story collection that I wrote is that I think this is just so ludicrous that I can't even believe it's true, but I do think it's true. I think that often people who live in the Midwest are not given credit for leading lives, like, either sort of external or interior lives, that are as complex as the lives of people who live on the coasts. And I wanted to write stories that are, most of the protagonists are women, but who are, like, emotionally complicated and intelligent. And to me, it doesn't seem at all contradictory that they would live in the Midwest. And sometimes they feel like out of sync with the people around them. But, you know, other times they have friends who are as edgy and sarcastic as they are, even though the story might take place in, like, Minnesota or Ohio. Yeah.
I mean, I call that the Mrs. Bridge effect, you know, where, you know, because Evan S. Cannell wrote that great novel, and it's a great novel, and it's set in Kansas City, but it also portrays a certain kind of blinkeredness for Midwesterners that I think is, like, held on as a trope for way longer than has actually been accurate for reality.
Yeah, I'm not even convinced it's ever been accurate. I mean, again, it's just so hard to say something that's true of a very wide, varied group of people.
Speaking of, all right, so here's a personal revelation. My aunt lived on the same street as Cannell and knew his mom. And I was once talking to her about Mrs. Bridge, and I asked her, was she really like that, Cannell's mother? And Jeanette said, well, she was. That was her answer.
What does that mean?
Meaning, like, she was like that, but not everyone was.
Oh, that's interesting. I know, isn't it? I do feel like that whole thing of, I feel like it's like fiction is, it's not, you shouldn't assume it's all autobiographical, except, of course, usually it is or something.
So we are pretend recording this show in December of 1997. And beginning in September of this year, a woman named Linda Tripp began secretly recording her conversations with another woman named Monica Lewinsky. In those tapes, Monica Lewinsky talks about having a sexual relationship with President Clinton. Tripp gives the tapes to Ken Starr, who's investigating Clinton for something else. This news breaks, and in late January 1998, Bill Clinton has that famous news conference in the White House where he says, "I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Lewinsky." It's been interesting to see that conversation resurface in light of the Weinstein reporting and all of the subsequent reporting about all of the different people in power, men in power, who have been in some way abusive or created hostile work environments for their staff, or far, far worse. And also to see the Anita Hill conversation resurface. And I think, you know, I was in college a little bit after that. And I mean, I remember sort of, like, the common rhetoric, and probably my rhetoric as well, sort of being a thing that, you know, I wasn't interested in. I think there was a lot of slut shaming of Monica Lewinsky, and I wasn't particularly interested in that, but I also wasn't interested in any kind of accountability for Bill Clinton.
I remember being framed as, should he be allowed to have an affair, and does that matter? And, you know, that obviously is the wrong framing now.
Yeah.
But that's how it was framed at the time. Am I remembering that right? Was that true for
wait, y'all? Do you think that's the wrong framing because she was an intern and he was the president?
Yeah.
And so there is no sort of equal affair.
That's what I think. I mean, I think that seems like a persuasive argument.
I do think that Monica Lewinsky was slut-shamed. And I think particularly by women a half generation or generation older than I was, where people could, you know, like, it seems like people made a lot of jokes. But then simultaneously, something I remember, because I'm just like a couple years younger than she is. And I remember people saying, you know, if she was 24 or 25, like, and he was president, she didn't know better, which is a form of, I mean, it's kind of condescending, but it's a form of compassion. And I thought, okay, I'm a little younger than her, like almost like, so am I not responsible for my own behavior? Or like, does anything I do not count? Like, for how many more years does it not count? And I actually, I have an enormous amount of compassion for her. Like, I think that her life does seem from a great distance novelistic, in the sense that she has had to pay, it seems, an extraordinarily high price for choices that she made at a very young age that, you know, I think, by the way, does either of you follow her on Twitter? She's funny. Not.
I don't, but I've read some other things that she's written, and she just seems like incredibly smart. A lot of what she's done about, she's, I think, been an activist in some bullying related things, anti-bullying initiatives. And I've been really impressed by her work on that. I mean, just like in every instance that I encounter her now. And I think, she was definitely slut shamed. I think, I guess when I look back at my own response, I can only defend the part of myself where I wasn't interested in that. And I think also now that I look back on it, I realize that I think I probably was surrounded by people who also were slut shaming her, probably primarily men. And I don't think I particularly resisted that in any way that I should have. I think like the thing that I really can't defend is that I think because of the framing that Whit referred to, that, you know, Bill Clinton should be allowed to have an affair because that was his personal business and not anything to do with the running of the nation.
I mean, his reputation sort of now is so totally different.
Right. And I think like Curtis, I absolutely agree with you, like the extraordinarily high price for decades. I mean, it's 20 years later.
Right. And then her name has such a particular meaning, or you can use it as like a shorthand or a punchline, but it's like, she's a real person.
Yeah.
I mean, I would encourage people to go back and read, you know, some of that stuff, because I'd forgotten a lot of stuff. I mean, we had a show on political betrayal, but, you know, Linda Tripp was somebody she just told these stories to, like as a confidant.
Yeah.
And then who totally screwed her over and taped her and gave those tapes to Ken Starr. And in fact, Linda Tripp also, there's a literary angle. Linda Tripp went and talked to this like famous conservative literary agent about what to do and got advice on this. I mean, it was just this kind of really unpleasant way that story came out.
Yeah. Where like she, Monica Lewinsky, seems like she was sort of doubly betrayed, if not more so. Wait, when you say I encourage people to go back and read it, what do you encourage people specifically?
I mean, read
to go
news
back
stories and about it. And, you know, just look them up on the internet. The twists and turns of this are sort of get lost in the past, but they're fascinating.
Yeah.
Of course, your novel American Wife is told from the point of view of Laura Bush, and she was a very different and probably more traditional kind of first lady than Hillary Rodham Clinton. And I know that you are working on a novel from the point of view of Hillary Clinton, which I'm excited about. And I'm wondering how you thought of those two scandals. Did the echoes of the Clinton scandal influence the way you thought about Laura Bush and lead you to the project that you're working on now? Do you think it influenced the way Laura Bush approached her role as first lady in the wake of all of this Monica Lewinsky, Bill Clinton stuff, or even lead to a president like George Bush getting elected?
In terms of Laura Bush, like I don't think the fact that I wrote a novel with a character loosely based on her, a main character, was like a particular reaction to the Clintons. It was more like at one point I was sort of fascinated by Laura Bush, and I'm a Democrat. So some of my friends would kind of say like, why are you so interested, or why do you admire her, and have Republican operatives planted a chip in your brain? And I wrote this article Salon, where I said, this is in, my God, the years have all collapsed. I think maybe in like 2006-ish, I wrote an article where I had read a biography by the Washington Post writer Ann Gerhart about Laura Bush. And I said, Laura Bush's life is like a great novel where, you know, all these sort of improbable but dramatic things have happened to her. And then like literally a year and a half later, I was like, oh my God, it's like a novel I should write. Which of course, if I had known I would do that, I would never have announced in an article that her life was novelistic, let alone said it's like a great novel. And then it's like, so it was more like that particular story just fascinated me. And then almost like for that same reason, like I want to feel really interested in the book I'm writing and I want to feel consumed and I don't want to do the same thing over and over again. And so I thought, I don't think I'll probably do what I did with Laura Bush and American Wife in another novel. Like, I just thought, like, for my own sake, I don't want to, you know, whatever, do it over. But actually what I'm doing is the premise of my novel is, what if Hillary Clinton, well, Hillary Rodham, had gone to Yale Law School, as she did in real life, met and fallen in love with Bill Clinton. And then also, this happened in real life, he proposed to her several times and she said no. And then finally she said yes. And the premise of my novel is, what if she had never said yes? Oh. And so they are a couple and then they go their separate ways. So I think there are like three sections to the novel. And the first one is, you know, 70% grounded in fact. And then the second section and the
third section. That's a pretty high percentage.
Well,
for me,
70% of one third. I'll let you do that math. I don't know how many writers it
takes. I can't do that math.
But then, you know, almost 0% of section two and section three are factual. Like, they have a relationship to, but, like, you know, things would have played, like if, you know, like, would Bill Clinton have run for president? Would he have won?
I am fascinated to read that, and lucky for our listeners to get to hear you talk about it a little bit. All right, so there's one more literary event from 1997 that is arguably more important than anything we've discussed so far. This book did not win any prizes. It was not noticed, as far as I can tell, by anyone in the literary establishment. But Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone was published in June of 1997 by Bloomsbury in the UK. They paid £2,500 for it. The print run was 500 copies. When did the two of you become aware of Harry Potter? For me, it certainly wasn't in 1997.
I think for me it was 2000, where actually at Fast Company, the magazine that I had worked for, I went back for a sort of like there was some, I don't know, barbecue or something that they were having, like a kind of like staff event. And I happened to be in the area. And so I went for it. And people thought that a female employee who had started working at the magazine after I had departed looked like Harry Potter. And I think I was like, who's Harry Potter? And then once someone had said the words Harry Potter, then I saw Harry Potter, you know, it was like on the cover of Newsweek and everywhere else. I have a confession. I still haven't read Harry Potter. I'm waiting for my kids so that, like, there came a point when this was in like 2002 or 2003, I read the first 60 pages of the first book, and I thought to myself, if I ever have children, I think it'd be more fun to read this with them, and I'm going to put it on hold.
I think it would be really fun to read with kids. I read it, it was this summer when, oh my gosh, amazing. I was an intern at the Chronicle of Higher Education. And maybe one of my roommates, I was living in this group house with three other people, and one of whom was Dave Farenthold. And someone else in the house had a copy of the fourth book, which I think had come out, and I borrowed it from that person. And that was actually a great place for me to start because it was so plotty and juicy. But in 1997, I had no idea about Harry Potter at all. And it's amazing to me with it. I mean, the £2,500, 500 copies, it's astonishing. And it's nice also to, like, kind of look back at this 20 years ago business and sort of see that as much as a lot of the news about publishing is about exciting successes and flashy things, and I'm, you know, really happy about those things too, but it's also nice to see that sort of those slower blooming things also happen.
It changed now, the industry so much.
Yeah.
Invented the YA novel, as far as I can tell. I mean, I maybe somebody would tell me something else did.
I think I have a feeling you'd get pushback for that.
Yeah.
I don't know what the nature of the pushback would be, but I feel like you might have an interesting conversation might be born of that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, as an Ellen Emerson White fan, I would have to argue. but wait, I'm going to send you these books. That's what's going to happen.
I haven't read those.
But yeah, I mean, like, you know, J.K. Rowling is now writing as a, she's writing under a different name. She's writing mysteries. But yeah, it did totally change book sales in the industry. And yeah, I think you're going to have such a good time reading them with your kids. I'm almost a little jealous that you'll get to read them for the first time in that way.
Well, that's what we're doing now. So that's how I'm coming to
what
it.
What are you, late. Where are you? Like, what book are you
well,
on?
Well, I mean, my youngest, my eldest son, who's 12, has read all of them. And then the 7-year-old is now embarking. So he's probably, I think he's about book 2.
And have you read them, or are you reading them with him?
Read with, mostly.
Yeah.
That's fun. And so I was referring just then to the fact that J.K. Rowling's real name was Joanne, and her publisher, who is male, thought that Harry Potter sounded like a quote-unquote boys book, which I can imagine would definitely get pushback now. And he believed that boys preferred to read books that were written by men. So he asked her to use a pen name that sounded more male. And I think that tells you something about the publishing industry in 1997.
Yeah, I mean, look, okay, Mary Ann Evans changed her name to George Eliot in the 1850s, right? But 100 years, more than 100 years later, it's surprising to me that that was the same. Maybe it shouldn't be surprising to me that it's the same story. But, you know, I wanted to ask the two of you, how did it feel to be an aspiring writer who happened to be a woman in 1997 as compared to today? I mean, were you considering changing your names?
I don't think either of us needed to, apparently.
Well, I have a female name, so, you know, I'm all for the, you know, sexually androgynous name.
I don't know. So there's a strange compliment that I've gotten over the years, and I wonder if you've ever gotten the sort of reverse compliment with, which is sometimes people, like, either in an online review, someone will say this, or in person, they'll be like, you know, Curtis Sittenfeld, how does he do such a good job getting into the minds of women? Like, it's so convincing. And I'm sort of like, well, not to let you down. But so I think, so my real first name is Elizabeth. My parents are the ones who decided at birth to call me Curtis. And I think knowing everything I know now, I would publish under Elizabeth. Just because it's like avoiding the slight confusion, and it also might allow me to be like Curtis in my normal life and then like Elizabeth as a public writer or something. But it's not something that like I stress about in an active way. Like, it just sort of is what it is.
Yeah, I think, God, it's amazing to hear you say that you would publish under a different name. I started using VV as my initials and my byline back right after I graduated from college, and had a conversation with a mentor about it. And one of the things was just that I had double first initials, so they were cool.
They are cool, by the way.
Thank you. Thanks very much. And I guess, like, I didn't particularly, I mean, I guess you can make an argument for them as androgynous, but I guess I personally didn't think of them as male coded. Like, in South Asia, lots of women use initials, and I can think of other women who use initials. And so I just sort of, I think I've always sort of felt like I don't get why men should get to dominate initials along with everything else. But I have had some funny conversations with people who are sort of like, I remember actually meeting another writer. I think I was checking out her apartment. She was sort of like, it was sort of the first question out of her mouth. She was introduced to me, and she was sort of like, hello, do you use initials so that people think you're a man? And I was kind of like, no.
All right. So it's 2:00 on a winter afternoon in 1997. We're going to end the podcast, but I just want to know what you guys are going to go do for the rest of the day. If it's 1997.
I'm going to go read the new issue of Esquire that I have a subscription to.
Well, I mean, that's interesting in what we were just talking about. I mean, it was that men's magazines were really dominant for fiction writers.
That's true.
Right? In a way that they don't quite seem to be so now.
1997, Sugi would have had no idea, because she would have been going to her, no joke, electric typewriter to work on her college applications.
All right. Well, have fun with that. Curtis, thanks so much. Go ahead. What do you have?
I hope you get into your first choice.
Terrible, isn't it? Thank you so much for taking time to be on the show during your holiday break.
Thank you both. It was fun time traveling with you.
Yeah, thanks, Curtis. And congratulations on You Think It, I'll Say It. That book's coming out in April. I would strongly encourage our listeners to go out and pre-order.
Thank you, but what a pleasure. And thank you for your patience in teaching me to use Skype.
Felt like it was 1997 there for a little while.
All right, thank you, guys.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye.
And that's it for the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast. Our In the Stack segment with J.J. Cantrell. We'll be back in 2 weeks after the nation's bookstore owners are done selling you books for the holidays. Our theme music is composed by Travis Workman. You can subscribe to us in iTunes, on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or at the Literary Hub website. Thanks to the wonderful listeners who heard our plea and have been posting reviews on iTunes and following us on Facebook at FNF Pod or on Twitter at FNF Talk. Happy reading, and as Faith Evans and the then-named Puff Daddy said in the 1997 hit memorializing Notorious B.I.G., till the day we meet again, in my heart is where I keep you, friend.